Are you feeling overwhelmed by hormonal changes? If you're a woman, you're definitely not alone. More than 1,000 hormone disruptors are living rent-free in our environment right now. In our food, our water, the air we breathe, the clothes we wear, our skincare, and they all mess with our hormones. The good news is that we don't have to suffer through any of it anymore, because now we have Hormone Harmony, a formula made only with herbal ingredients that are shown to reduce hormonal symptoms in women of all ages. Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now here's the beauty of adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. That's why Hormone Harmony is perfect for women of all ages who are struggling with life-disrupting symptoms, such as PMS symptoms like irritability, moodiness, discomfort, or uncontrollable cravings, menopause symptoms like hot flashes or night sweats, racing thoughts, low moods, poor sleep and feeling tired all the time, occasional bloating and gas. Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. And that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromises when it comes to quality, and it shows. For a limited time, you can get 15% off of your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code RAIN at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code RAIN for 15% off today. We're barely into the new year and it feels like it's been a year, right? Well, I want to talk really quick about a personal testimony for something that has helped me with my physical and mental health, which is Magic Mind. Over COVID, I was diagnosed with ADHD and an anxiety disorder. And as anyone dealing with the medical world can tell you, it can feel impossible to get the right help and medication. I know the calming and mental enhancing supplements like Cognizin, citicoline, and lion's mane mushroom got me through that very trying time.
It's not something that we were gauging or I was really even thinking about when we started taking Magic Mind. But very quickly, we both noticed a huge uptick in energy and our minds being clear and focused. Mm-hmm. I was astonished. I could not believe it was really working. It worked. And I love it. And I like the taste of it.
Which always helps.
Magic Mind. You won't mind, comma, the taste.
And here's an insider tip. The team at Magic Mind has come out with a sleep performance shot that helps with sleep. Unlike pills, there are no groggy side effects, and it doesn't force you to sleep. The natural ingredients just help you to relax into sleep. So check that out, too, while you're setting up your subscription to Magic Mind. You can get 45% off your first bundle by going to magicmind.com/rain. That's 45% off by going to magicmind.com/rain. So go take a look at the website, learn all about the research and ingredients that have gone into Magic Mind. And once you decide to give it a try, you can get your discount at magicmind.com/rain.
Magic Mind. A different kind of energy.
Murder in the Rain, where each week Emily Rowney, Alicia Holland, and Josh McCullough tell true crime stories of the Pacific Northwest. Murder in the Rain contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised. For some of us elder millennials and Gen Xers, it is hard to believe that when someone talks about 50 years ago, it isn't the 1950s, it's the 1970s. On Christmas Eve 1977, 47 years ago, a murder took place. There is a bevy of possible suspects, even motives, but no one has been brought to justice. As the years tick on, suspects have passed away, evidence has been destroyed, and the chances of solving the murder of 21-year-old Terry Lee Foster have dwindled. So to honor the 47th anniversary of her death, over the next two episodes, I'll be telling you the life story of Terry and presenting the surprising amount of known possible suspects. Hopefully, someone listening knows something, and we can bring this family answers and let Terry rest in peace. It was noon on Christmas Eve, 1977, when Robert Bolger and his son Brent were walking past David Douglas Park in Vancouver, Washington. For locals, that's on North Garrison Road just off Mill Plain Boulevard, just about 10 minutes northwest of the Portland Airport. The baseball diamond in the southern portion of the park was under construction, and as the Bolgers passed it, the body of a young woman lying in the field caught their eye. 911 was called, and soon the park was swarming with police and investigators. The Caucasian woman's body was face down with her head facing southeast, her legs northwest. Turned onto her back, bruising of her nose and eyes showed a beating had taken place, or what the police would refer to in the papers as a roughing up. Because there were no footprints, but there were tire tracks, it was clear the woman had been dumped from a vehicle and she had been dead since the early morning hours. The young woman had been wearing a blue Levi Strauss jean jacket atop a cowl neck long-sleeved shirt with multicolored horizontal stripes. Like something out of a movie, the Carvalho watch on her wrist was stopped at what very well could have been her time of death, 1:50. Rings adorned her fingers, as did earrings in her ears. She was nude below the waist, save her shoes and socks. In addition to those missing clothes, there was no sign of a purse or wallet. At 4:30 that same afternoon, an officer was dispatched to Indiana Street in Vancouver, just about two blocks from where the body had been found. A man named Carl had come across a purse lying in the middle of the street, its contents strewn across the road. The purse held receipts, discount cards, medical cards, vehicle registration, a birth certificate, medical bills, notes, food stamp coupons, a temporary instructional permit, Fred Meyer coupons, a letter, a baby's health record book, and a home seeker's form. There was also a Christmas card list with a Dennis Manning found among the names, but we'll get back to that later. There is a bit of a quirky story behind the missing jeans. The following Friday, on December 30th, detectives working the case received a call from a Patricia Lively. She had seen news reports about the murder in the park and that a pair of jeans connected to the case were missing. When she realized the jeans her brother Russell had found at the intersection of Akron and Michigan, streets that border the park, were the ones being looked for. Her sweet brother had stumbled upon them, brought them home, washed them, and wrapped them up as a gift for his niece, Patricia's daughter. They were then taken in to be processed as evidence. The most helpful of all of the recovered items was the permit in the purse. Even though it was temporary, it included a name and address. Going to the address listed on East 13th Street, officers met with 68-year-old Nestor Skrico, the homeowner, and his 18-year-old son, Kevin. They knew the woman on the license the police were showing them. It was their new roommate, 21-year-old Terry Foster. The next day, which was Christmas, two detectives arrived at the home of a man named James. Just as close to the park as the purse had been found at the intersection of Indiana Street and Detroit Avenue, James discovered the missing wallet. There was no money inside, but what was found was as good as gold. Inside the floral purple wallet were two social security cards, some photos, business cards, notes, and a Portland Community College ID card. The socials were for Terry Foster and Fawn Foster. This confirmed the wallet was from the same person who was also their victim. In August 1977, Terry Foster moved into the home on East 13th Street. Nestor rented Terry a spare room, which was a fine but temporary situation to keep a roof over her head as she searched for an apartment of her own. Speaking with detectives, Nestor said that he hadn't seen Terry since midnight as the 23rd turned into Christmas Eve. Now that detectives had positive identification for their victim, they had to work backwards. They learned that a week prior, Terry had started working at the now-defunct Edelweiss Inn German and American restaurant at 8800 Northeast Highway 99 in Vancouver. On Friday the 23rd, Terry had slept in before her shift started. She completed her shift, and roommate Nestor picked her up and they went home. After preparing for a night out, Terry caught a ride with Kevin at 11 p.m., Along for the ride was Kevin's friend, Sam Manning, a young man who was stationed at Fort Lewis. The three piled into Sam's yellow 1976 Subaru and were off. The two young men told investigators that they had taken Terry to her usual spot, Little John's Pub, located in the Five Corners Shopping Center, just about 4 miles north of David Douglas Park. It's unclear if the guys hung around for the remaining couple of hours that the pub was open, or if they did their own thing before returning to give Terry a ride back home when the bar closed at 2 a.m. By then, Terry was, according to Kevin, intoxicated. After getting home and dropping Terry off, Kevin went to his mother's home in Washougal for the night. Just 15 minutes later, Terry would be seen walking out the front door of the house. She didn't appear to be distressed. She was alone and she left on foot. She neglected to inform anyone where she was going or if she was meeting up with anyone. What happened between that 2 a.m. walk out the door and the noon discovery of her body remains unclear. What is known is there was a work holiday party, a visitor named Dennis came to her home, and at least four men had the opportunity, motive, and history to be considered part of the compelling suspect list. So let's get into the details of Terry's life before her murder, those final hours, and the history of said suspects. None of my research revealed any surprising details or some sort of shocking backstory to Terry's life. Her parents were married and in their late 20s when they had Terry Lee Foster in Tacoma, Washington, on July 9, 1956. The youngest of six children, I can only imagine how busy the household was, with six kids, all within just a few years of each other. Oof. I'm pretty sure the photo I found is of Terry when she was in high school, though I'm not sure if she completed her education. As is the case with anyone who is struggling, we don't really know the full story as to what led to Terry living a life some judged as being irresponsible. Now, we could all speculate on one cause or another as to what led to Terry's choices and situation. Not her murder, of course, but her custody and living situations. Anything from issues in childhood, issues with parents being abused or struggling with mental health, there's just a myriad of reasons and we'll never know the real cause. When Terry was 18, she moved from Portland to Vancouver. In 1975, when Terry was about 18 or 19, she became pregnant. The pregnancy didn't appear to be the result of a relationship, and all that's known is that the guy's name was Carrie, and he was not in the picture. And yes, it's Carrie and Terry, but don't worry, that's the only mention of Carrie. Sometime between March and October 1976, Terry gave birth to her daughter, Fawn, at St. Vincent's Hospital in Portland. I apologize for all of the ambiguity, but with a case this old and without the help of the assigned investigator and a lot of redaction in the reports, there are some holes in her backstory. There wasn't information about the specifics, but Terry did lose temporary custody of Fawn, and she was placed with a foster family. The family that ended up caring for Fawn were not strangers. They were her, at one time, babysitters, Kenneth and Janice Haynes. It was December 3, 1977, just 21 days before Terry's murder, that Fawn would be placed in the temporary care of the Haynes. In those 21 days, Terry visited her daughter on at least four occasions, including the night of the 23rd, when she was allowed to take Fawn from the Haynes home to her parents' place in Alloa, about 20 miles southwest from Vancouver, for a Christmas celebration and dinner. Terry's specifically timed drop-off of Fawn that night was the last time Kenneth or Janice claimed to have seen Terry. During that final holiday visit, Millie, Terry's mother, gifted her daughter a $100 check, which was not found in her wallet or purse, and promised her that they would do whatever it would take to help get Fawn back into Terry's care. That would never come to fruition, and after Terry's death, the Haynes adopted Fawn. She has since changed her name, but for her own privacy, we will not be sharing that name. Later on Christmas Eve, the foster home received a phone call. Andrew, Terry's father, answered it. He didn't say who it was or what it was about. It wouldn't be until later that evening that Millie would learn of her daughter's death from her daughter-in-law, who had learned the news from her husband, James. Millie believed that someone had informed James, who then called his father, Andrew. This would allow the family to enjoy one last Christmas Eve, as Andrew didn't let on that he had just been informed his daughter was found murdered. A year prior to the murder, Terry was living with her friend, Jean Ann, on Northeast 106th Avenue in Vancouver, just about 2 miles from the Skirico residence. It sounds like a youthful Golden Girls situation. There were three ladies in their 20s living their lives in the booming metropolis of Vancouver. But that arrangement didn't last long. By the end of the summer, Terry moved out of her room at Jean Ann's place to move in with a longtime boyfriend, Raymond Wilson. It was when that relationship came to an end that Terry took up renting the spare room at Nestor's. As for Terry's personality, it was noted by several friends and family members that Terry could be reserved or quiet until she got to know you, or vice versa. In her own way, she was a bit of a loner, a rebel, but she wasn't the type of girl with a list of people who wanted her dead. Okay, now for what some might feel is the tough part, the point in the story where a person's lifestyle might skew how you think of the victim, where the ideas of how could she, or maybe she had it coming, might take away from the seriousness of her case or the fact that a murderer is still walking free. Yes, Terry was the mother to a less than 2-year-old baby, but she was only 21 years old, so she made some less than ideal choices for reasons that we will never understand. We aren't here to judge her choices, nor should her choices be a reason to ignore the lack of justice for her murder. Terry was known as being a party girl. A week before her death, she started working as a server at Edelweiss, but before that, she was pretty open about not having income and would often ask to borrow money from friends, which she usually paid back, or at least some of it. According to at least one friend, Terry was not known to engage in sex work and was not a promiscuous person. She had boundaries when it came to physicality. Terry was protective of her space if someone was trying to get fresh or make a move. She just didn't hold those same boundaries when it came to partying. It was reported that Terry had opposite boundaries when it came to drug use. There was no reporting or implication that Terry had been an addict, but it was reported that she was known for her willingness to try pretty much any and everything. Her vice of choice was supposedly alcohol, and there was at least one person in her life who felt she may have been suffering from alcohol addiction. That same friend felt that from the outside, Terry's lifestyle came across as being quite risky, though it didn't seem that she felt that it was. From everything I read, it sounded like Terry was living the life of a slightly more extreme, troubled teen. I didn't find anything about an arrest history or serious drug use. She was a young mother who was possibly in the process of losing custody, but not visitation, of her daughter. Some might find that unfathomable. Some might say, yep, been there at that age. We all make mistakes. That's pretty much all there is about Terry's background. So let's get closer to the time of her murder. On the 23rd of December, Terry was talking with a coworker, Colleen David. What was said isn't known, but the context was that Terry was feeling and expressing emotion about Fawn. It seems the custody situation was in limbo, and Terry was scared that it would become long-term or even permanent. To cheer her friend up, Colleen suggested Terry attend the holiday party being thrown that night by their fellow coworker, Robin. The party was for Edelweiss staff, and anyone who's ever worked in food service can tell you this was going to be one hell of a party. Terry passed on the invite as she already had plans of being picked up by someone. To celebrate the holidays together, Dennis David, Colleen's brother, had driven up to Vancouver from California in his new white Datsun. On the 23rd, Dennis dropped by his sister's work, Edelweiss, where he met Terry. The two hit it off, and eventually Terry gave Dennis her address and phone number. Hoping to make a date, Dennis also mentioned the party and suggested they both attend. Now that he had her address, he even offered to give her a ride. Without a specific reason, she said that she wasn't going to be able to go. Perhaps she did have plans to meet up with someone specific at Little John's Pub. Don't worry about ringing that good police bell. Even in the same police report, there are conflicting facts about Colleen. One statement claims that she went to the party and took her brother Dennis with her. Another page shows that she denied ever going to the party. I'm guessing the detectives never felt confident as to what the truth was, and with witnesses conflicting with Colleen's statement, they kind of just put both in the report. Colleen's attendance wasn't important, as it is possible she stayed home with her husband John, and her presence is really only related to a possible cover-up. Her account was that she and Dennis left the restaurant and went home. Dennis waited by the phone for a while to see if Terry would call him for a ride. When she didn't, he went to the party. When Terry didn't arrive, he grew impatient and utilized the knowledge of her address to drop by. Arriving at the Skirico residence, Dennis knocked on the door and asked for Terry. He was told that she had left the house and was walking somewhere. He then returned to the party before going back to his sister's house. Dennis told Colleen about Terry's absence, and they all went to bed. It appeared no one had seen Terry as she was walking from the house to her unknown location, leaving her roommates and the murderer as the last to have seen her. Instead of opening gifts on Christmas Eve, Dr. Archie Hamilton was opening up the body of 21-year-old Terry Foster, finding a cerebral edema or brain swelling, acute passive hypermia and edema of the lungs, meaning they were filled with blood and fluid, a bruised scalp, left eye, and nose. The matter of death was listed as a homicide caused by strangulation and the fluids in her lungs. A vaginal swab found spermatozoa and acid phosphatase.
Yeah, that sounded good.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
A phosphatase. And acid phosphatase were found in vaginal secretions. Acid phosphatase levels can determine the time frame in which intercourse has occurred. The sperm was collected as evidence, as were fingernail scrapings, pubic hair combings, pubic hair, head hair, and vaginal secretions, which were turned over to the Clark County Prosecutor's Office. Noted in Terry's autopsy and the single line on the Vancouver Police cold case page is that she had tattoos. It was in the 1970s that tattoos started to become embraced by regular folk, not just those who fought in wars or sailed the high seas. This was mostly due to the hippies of the 60s. Though it was becoming more popular, tattoos were not exactly part of the mainstream in 1977, especially on a young woman. So it was notable that on Terry's left arm, there were peculiar little dots and an amateurish cross. It is not known when or how Terry acquired these markings. So there it is. Terry was beaten about the head and face and raped before being strangled to death. The police? Oh boy. They told the Columbian, quote, "Seldom is anybody beat up unless she is raped. So far as I'm concerned, it's a rape-murder case," which was implying the murder wasn't the goal, just the rape, so she was kind of beaten into submission. Then they really turned up the heat on my rage meter by skipping any implication and just saying that this was a whoopsie. Quote, "It's pure speculation on the sequence," said a detective, meaning they didn't know if she was hit, raped, or murdered first, adding, quote, "We're up to a point where we can't rule out anything. It's hard to say if it was an intentional murder. It might have been an accident." As if some poor guy was just trying to have a good time by having his way with this young woman, and in doing so, he accidentally held her throat closed with at least 11 pounds of pressure for at least 3 minutes, if not 5 to 7. Whoopsies. So what was known by this point? Terry's daughter was being cared for by the Haynes. She had started at Edelweiss a week before, and that night there was an employee party at Robin's house. Dennis, who was visiting his sister Colleen, attended the party, left to go to Terry's house to try to convince her to join, but she was gone. Earlier in the night, Terry had been out at a local pub. She was dropped off at home by Kevin and Sam, and she left on foot after 2 a.m., and her body was found 10 hours later. So let's look at these suspects. I'm going to start with the most famous of the suspects. I think he's also the first to be removed from the list, but there are areas in history that are worth noting. This is actually a snippet I borrowed and tweaked from Emily's episode, Eye for an Eye. A 17-year-old boy named Danny Miller was walking home after his shift at McDonald's in Vancouver, Washington. It was Labor Day weekend, 1989, and it was warm. As he walked up the hill of Northeast Andreessen Road, the end of summer heat made the walk nearly unbearable, even though it was 7 o'clock in the evening. Danny stopped halfway up the hill to catch his breath. After a brief rest, he conquered the remainder of the hill. He then started walking on a trail through David Douglas Park, which was his usual shortcut home. However, on that day, there was someone lying in his path. As he got closer, he realized the person was a seriously injured young boy. Danny made several attempts to wake the boy, but there was no response. Given the alarming amount of blood on and around the boy, it seemed that something terrible had happened. Perhaps, since they were so close to the main road, it had been a car accident or a hit and run. Thankfully, the boy was still alive and breathing. Danny looked around for help, but the park was empty. Hoping the boy could hold on, Danny ran down the hill he had just climbed, ran 3 blocks, and came upon a convenience store. He called 911 and described to the dispatcher that he had found an injured and likely dying young boy who was either Asian or Native American. Within a few minutes, police arrived at David Douglas Park and located the boy on the trail. The first responders realized immediately that these injuries were not caused by a car accident. The boy had several stab wounds in his chest and abdomen. He also had what appeared to be defensive wounds on his legs. His injuries were so severe that he was life-flighted to Emmanuel Hospital in Portland, where sadly he was pronounced dead at 7:37 p.m. At first, the victim was referred to as Junior Doe, but just 90 minutes later, a man named Claire Neer called police at 9 p.m. to report his two sons as missing. Only a year apart in age, Billy and Cole Neer were always together. That day, they headed towards the Vancouver driving range where they would frequently go to bike around collecting golf balls. Once a bucket was filled, they could turn it in and get paid. Their usual plan had them ball collecting for about an hour and a half. When they didn't arrive home for dinner as expected, their father worried as it was highly unusual for them to be late. He looked for them through the neighborhood, but when he wasn't able to find them or their bikes, his worry increased and he called the police. This call was a devastating shock for those working on the case of Junior Doe, as they realized there was likely another boy somewhere in that park. After shutting down the northbound lanes on Andreessen Road, roughly a dozen searchers took to the park with flashlights that night. Starting from where Billy's body had been located earlier that evening, it took only minutes for two BMX bikes to be discovered under a bush on the side of a trail. After hours of searching, a second body was found roughly 100 yards away from the trail. Under heavy brush, about 20 yards from the bikes, searchers located Cole Neer. He was flat on his back, his pants and underwear were pulled down, and he was stabbed several times in a manner similar to his brother. After positive identification of the boys, 11-year-old Cole's time of death paired with the discovery of 10-year-old Billy's body, which helped the coroner estimate the attack had likely occurred between 6:15 and 6:45. A motive wasn't clear. The boys didn't show evidence of torture, and police were unsure if they had been sexually assaulted. This left investigators with little to go on. All they knew is there was a monster on the loose who had no problem attacking children up close and personal with a 6-inch blade. As one would expect, the investigation into who killed these two little brown boys in a quiet park in Vancouver was an utter shitshow. Even with what would end up being an incredibly accurate profile, there were few leads. There was a possible eyewitness who saw a man talking to two boys with bikes in the park and who was able to work with a sketch artist to provide a description. The man was likely between 18 and 30 years old. He had a slight, slender build. He was between 5'10 and 6 feet. He had uncombed dark hair. They also had a psychological profile of the killer that was put together by Dr. Ronald Turco. The profile stated that, quote, he would be 25 to 35 years old and kicked out of the military if he served. He would be a loner and probably kept photos of his victims, a diary of his offenses, including clipped articles, and child sex abuse material. The killer probably chose boys because he saw girls as defective, end quote. With only one stranger involved in the case thus far, police latched on to Danny, the man who had found Billy Neer. For 9 weeks, Danny became the focus of the police investigation. Was Danny covered in blood, as you would expect from a stabbing? No. Did Danny have a solid alibi, as he was at work prior to the discovery? Yeah. Did the police ruin a young man's life while they flailed around trying to get a lead? I think we can safely assume yes.
And it happened for a long time, if I recall.
Yeah, it says for 9 weeks, and that's just active, I would assume. So past that, you've got neighbors and community.
Yeah,
and
I think I recall it being even longer than that, that he just lived
just
in
trying
nightmare.
To go to the grocery store. Oh, it's awful. He did what any decent person would do and tried to get help for a dying child. But no good deed goes unpunished, and he wound up putting his life on hold while police picked it apart. He lost his friends, his neighbors wouldn't talk to him, and people started to look at him like he was guilty, even though he was never even officially named a suspect. The pain continued even after the police finally officially cleared him. The entire ordeal has caused him to suffer from PTSD for years. Needless to say, they eventually gave up as there was exactly zero evidence pointing to Danny. That left the police with nothing outside of a sketch. Eventually, they just had to wait until another kid showed up dead, and that's exactly what happened. In the weeks after the murders of Billy and Cole Neer, the Vancouver area was on high alert. Parents didn't want their kids out alone as no one had been arrested in the case. But like many horrific events, people talked about it less, it was in the news less frequently, and the appeal of sending kids to play outside for a few minutes of quiet time started to return. And eventually, life regained some normalcy for those not directly impacted until it happened again. There is a lot more to that story in case you haven't listened to that episode yet. If not, or you just need a refresher, you can find it on our Patreon for free or our YouTube page and just search
Episode 91, Eye for an Eye.
So here's a heartwarming story. Through the show, we have made all sorts of friends with all sorts of people, including my Australian pal, Gaz. When I was writing my story about Catherine Knight for the book Women Who Murder, available now, I checked in with him about slang and other Australian details. In exchange, I thanked him in the author portion of the book and mailed him a copy. Well, that gratitude was passed on, and in exchange for that, he put me in touch with an amazing artist who gifted me a t-shirt. And that artist is Streepy. This one-woman-owned queer business out of Austin, Texas, is home to fantastic art you can order as a print, shirt, tote, and more. I got to choose and went with a Pee Wee Herman shirt, but it was nearly impossible to pick a piece of their original artwork between Pee Wee, Romeo and Michelle, The Craft, Chapel Roan, What About Bob, The Wedding Singer, and so much more. I really could go on and on, but you should go check it out yourself at streepy.etsy.com. That's streepy.etsy.com. There are original pop culture designs, but also unique original artwork, or you can even inquire about a custom piece. At the very least, you can follow Mars Streepy on Instagram at creepstreeps, that's C-R-E-E-P-S-T-R-E-E-P-S, and go support her right now. Thanks.
Let's talk about hair. If you're like me, you want hair products that are naturally beneficial and environmentally friendly. That's why I'm excited to share OMG Beauty products with you, because life's too short for a bad hair day, right? OMG Hair Care is your new go-to for clean, luxurious hair. Say goodbye to hair care confusion and hello to OMG Hair Care, founded by Natalie, a dedicated hair colorist who knows what your hair really needs. Her boutique brand is all about making clean beauty easy and fabulous. Here's a few reasons why you might love OMG Hair Care. They start with pure ingredients. The products are formulated in Australia with organic, naturally derived ingredients free from sulfates, parabens, and known irritants. You can create and customize. Their shampoos and conditioners are formulated with nourishing ingredients to cleanse, condition, and revitalize your hair. And it's safe for all. OMG Hair Care products are gentle enough for children and perfect for sensitive scalps. They're small but mighty. It's a boutique brand, but their mission is big, keeping hair care products clean, naturally beneficial, and most importantly, fabulous. With OMG Hair Care, every shampoo feels like a mini spa day, because clean beauty isn't just a trend, it's a lifestyle. Join the movement and wave goodbye to confusing choices and say hello to hair care that's honestly good for you. Would you like to experience a great hair day? Then head to omgbeautyproducts.com. For a limited time, you can get 30% off your first order. Just use the code SHOWCODE30. That's omgbeautyproducts.com and use code SHOWCODE30 for 30% off your first order.
I think it is simply a coincidence that Wesley Allen Dodd killed those boys in the same park where Terry's body was found. The park is 88 acres of baseball fields, a dog park, a forested area, trails. Being in the middle of a pretty decent-sized city, including next to one of the main thoroughfares, if you're going to do some bad hide-it-in-the-forest stuff, this is one of the only large places in the area to do so. At the time of Terry's murder, Wesley Allen Dodd would have been only 16 years old. We've certainly heard of young folks committing atrocities like this, but it really doesn't fit with his known history. At 13, Dodd was exposing himself to other children. At 15, he was arrested for indecent exposure, but nothing violent. It wouldn't be until he was 20 that he would be caught attempting to abduct two young girls. From there, his rap sheet would grow. I would be surprised if in the midst of his indecent exposure and attempted kidnapping of young girls, he would suddenly stray into a middle-of-the-night rape and strangulation of a grown woman, or that a 16-year-old would have the wherewithal to drive to a dump site as to not leave his prints. So I am, in my completely unofficial capacity, removing Wesley Allen Dodd from the suspect list. But what a cursed park that is, huh?
Oh, it sure is.
Lord. At least three murders that we know of? Because of their distance, both physically and in the relationship sense, Millie, Terry's mother, did not know if Terry was planning on going to a party or if she was dating anyone. Opposite of Terry's friend, Millie felt that she was promiscuous, but that could very well be a young, unexpected grandmother's view. She knew Terry to drink a beer now and then and to smoke, but nothing about any serious substance issues. Millie was a bit in the dark and just happy to see her daughter when she got the rare chance. Information she could provide to detectives was that before Terry had started at Edelweiss, she had been employed at the Hilltop Stables in Alloa. She knew a man had worked at the stables named Robert Smith. Both Millie and Terry's brother Tim felt that he was maybe peculiar is the word, and that he could have been involved in the murder. That is the only mention of Robert, so we'll clear him from the list too. Tim, Terry's brother, also had concerns about someone else being a possible suspect, their half-brother, James, the one who had called to inform the family of Terry's death. At that time, James was spending a notably odd amount of time with his half-sister. Tim even felt James seemed interested in Terry.
Ew.
Additionally, James had a criminal past. I'm not sure exactly what that history entailed, but it did have the family concerned. Millie supported Tim's concerns, telling detectives that Terry was bothered by the constant contact and that they had felt James was not honest. Now, let's dissect the Edelweiss Christmas party. Robin Winches was hosting the party at her apartment. It kicked off at 11:30 p.m. and went on until the morning hours. In attendance was David Henriksen. I'm not sure how many people worked at Edelweiss, but he did not know Colleen by name, which could have been because she was fairly new as well. He did recall that an employee had been at the party and was introducing people to her brother who was visiting from California, and that was most likely Dennis David. Yes, there is a David and a Dennis David, and hold on to your butts because another Dennis will be entering the picture. David remembered that about half an hour after encountering the visiting brother, that man left the party. It's hard to tell in party time, but David felt that that guy returned to the party somewhere between 1 to 4 hours later, so between 1 and 5 a.m. David couldn't help but notice something strange about the guy when he returned. One of the lenses on the man's glasses was broken, and he had notably fresh scratches running down the left side of his face and neck.
Why on earth would you return to a party?
No one will notice.
1 to 5 a.m.? What kind of parties are happening? I'm too old for that.
And those are restaurant folk.
Yeah,
and I tell you,
true.
God bless them. They're hard workers and even harder partiers.
That is true. When I worked at a restaurant, I was up rather late.
Yeah. It's a good time. It's a dark time.
It's a dark time.
But thank you for your service. The true service members of our country. Yeah. So he goes back and he's like, no one will notice my glasses are broken or my face is scratched up. That's fine. David also noted that in the middle of the party, mind you, that this man's hair and clothes were totally disheveled. He then approached his sister. So what we know as Dennis goes up to his sister and said, let's go. She grabbed her stuff and they left. So I think that's the only reason he returned. Like he didn't go back and party. I think he popped in to grab his sister who he had
together.
Left. Yeah.
Got
but
it.
She also said she didn't go to the party.
Am I missing something that this is the sister he was into or is that someone else?
No, that was Terry. So this is Colleen who Terry was talking to at Edelweiss and she was upset about Fawn and she's like, hey, go to Robin's party. And she's like, no, I'm not going. Colleen is who Dennis David, he drove up from California to visit his sister, which is Colleen. So brother, sister, Dennis David and Colleen, they go to the party. Dennis leaves for some amount of time. He comes back beat up and all disheveled. They leave.
Thank you.
She tells police, I didn't go to the party. So there are so many names and I've mentioned a lot of names and I have no problem reiterating because I'm not a name person and there are so many repeated names. It's stupid. Gail Whiteley was also an employee at Edelweiss and attended the party. She remembered Terry starting work but not coming to the party. Someone that did was a woman she called Teresa, who was another new employee, who brought her visiting from California brother Dennis. Gail also saw Dennis leave the party and return an hour or so later with a broken lens and scratched face. She confirmed to detectives that the two left shortly after his return. So all I can think with that is Colleen was also a new employee. And if Edelweiss was anything like Gustav's, they probably had a lot of employees. And if somebody's new and you have a different shift, you're like, Teresa or Colleen or something. So that's my only assumption with that is she just didn't know her. Rebecca Windsor had also seen Terry upset at work on the 23rd, probably in regard to the situation with Fawn and not having her over Christmas. She did not remember the name, but knew that someone's brother was at Edelweiss and that he was visiting from California. Rebecca did not go to the party. Patricia Sullivan was employed at Edelweiss. She saw Terry when she was getting picked up by Nestor on the 23rd. She, too, knew about Teresa's visiting brother, or Colleen's, but did not go to the party. Another issue with Colleen's name getting mixed up is that some people called her Connie. So she's only there a few days or a week. You got a bunch of people working there. You're not going to be able to keep track. Now we have a second Robin. This is Robin Ortega. It was the 70s. It was Vancouver. There wasn't a ton of variety, okay? So Robin Ortega was also a server who attended the party. She, too, witnessed Colleen and her brother attending the party. Oh, and I lied. There's a third Dennis, but he's only in this story for this little second. Dennis Henriksen was an employee who saw Terry on the 23rd, and she was emotional. He did not go to the party. After interviewing everyone who had been at the party, Dennis David quickly moved to the top of the suspect list. Adding to their case was the fact that when the Sirico family was questioned, they claimed that a man, whom they were not familiar with, stopped by their house around 1 a.m., which was in the same time frame that witnesses said Dennis was away from the party. That unknown man told the family that his name was Dennis and he asked for Terry. Raymond Eddy, a stepbrother of Kevin's, who was over for the holiday, spoke with that man and told him that Terry was out for the night. Dennis asked him to tell Terry that he had come by and that if she wanted to get in touch with him, he would be at his sister's house. Raymond thought he heard the sister's name was Janine, which sounds a lot like Colleen, and Barbara, Raymond's wife, took down the message that said Dennis would be at his sister's house, and she gave it to Terry when she returned around 2 a.m. This interaction was also witnessed by their son, Raymond Scott. Based on all of those witness statements, a sketch was made of this Dennis person. The sketch had a shared and strong resemblance with, if not an official match, to Dennis Allen David, the visiting brother from California. For those reasons, Dennis David was brought in on December 28th and 29th and voluntarily took a polygraph exam and answered questions. In doing so, he waived his Miranda rights. James Wygant, the polygraph expert, conducted the exam. This was only 4 days since the party, so James was another witness to the scratches on Dennis's face and neck. He remembered the left lens of Dennis's wire-framed glasses being broken and held together with tape. He could tell the scratches on his skin weren't fresh, but they were no more than a couple of days old. When asked about the injuries, Dennis told James that they had occurred during a bar scuffle. Sure, people wear taped-up frames all the time, but a broken lens makes glasses moot. This supposed bar fight didn't appear to be a light tussle. It seemed to Mr. Wygant that Dennis had been attacked or really beaten up. The big questions for the polygraph were, did Dennis see Terry Foster later on Friday night after seeing her at Edelweiss? And did Dennis suffocate Terry Foster or block her breathing to cause her death? His response of no to both of those questions resulted in a physical response consistent with conclusive indications of deception. AKA, he failed. During the exam, Dennis gave a statement. He confirmed that he had seen Terry at Edelweiss that Friday afternoon. They spoke and she mentioned the situation with Fawn. He then admitted to being the Dennis that had gone to her house that night. He claimed that he did so at 1 a.m. to apologize to her, quote, for his sister's refusal at the Edelweiss to follow the victim home and return with her to a party, which I can't really make out the meaning of. But it does seem to contradict Colleen's story of having not gone to the party. But I seriously don't know what he even means by that. Like, sorry we didn't take you home from work or something. That was never the plan. As the interview continued, Dennis sort of confessed. It didn't seem like this was one of those 12-hour interrogations that lead to a false confession and arrest. This read more like the guy was presented with evidence, which he reacted to with a shrug, telling the detectives, quote, he thought it was possible that he killed the victim and that, in general, he was capable of rape or murder, but he did not remember killing this victim. In a second interview, he repeated that he may have committed the murder, but did not remember doing it. And you'd think that'd be the end of the story, but nope. Detectives then asked Dennis about his Datsun. He had driven his new Datsun coupe up from California. Even though it was a newer car, they asked about tires. The first brand that he mentioned was Michelin. Why was this important? Well, if you recall, there were not footprints at the scene, only tire tracks. Tire casts concluded that the marks came from a Michelin X radial. Based on the size and dimensions, the experts decided that the perpetrator's vehicle was either a VW Bug, a Fiat, both of which came from the factory with those tires, or a Datsun with replacement Michelin tires, just like the vehicle Dennis had driven into town. Mr. Wygant, the polygraph expert, told detectives in a later interview that Dennis appeared to have high anxiety and was nervous while he said, "A bunch of really goofy things. This guy really, it's like he really wanted to be regarded as a suspect. It was one of the more bizarre cases. For the most part, I do not remember tests I did 33 years ago, but I remember this guy." It probably is pretty memorable when a guy repeatedly claims that he probably did commit a horrible murder. He just can't remember it. Then Dennis brought up, on his own, that he had, quote, found a pair of pink panties in his luggage. The one item missing from Terry that had not been recovered was her underwear. When Dennis found them in his luggage, he asked his sister about them, and she claimed to have found them on the sofa. They weren't hers, so she assumed they belonged to a friend of Dennis and put them in his luggage. After the 2 days of polygraphs and conversation, Wygant informed Dennis that he had failed the tests, and because of everything that had been said, he felt Dennis was the responsible party. So he went for it and straight up asked Dennis what happened that night. Dennis became agitated before bursting out into tears. He started to insist that he had not killed Terry. With that, Wygant left and called in the detectives. Informed of Dennis's failed tests, they went into the room with him. For 5 minutes, Dennis cried out loudly that he had not killed Terry. He was so vocal that Wygant could hear him from the hallway. Dennis was then excused. Reviewing the exam after Dennis's dismissal, Wygant shared some other clues that could imply deception. Dennis's breathing was a deep, controlled breath. He would also frequently clear his throat. This allowed for Dennis to be characterized as not being cooperative to the test. Those actions didn't affect the test per se, but they are seen as actions taken by someone who is attempting to beat the test, to outsmart the polygraph. A truthful person just sits there and tells the truth without trying to rig anything or change their breathing. The confession, failed polygraph, admission of being in the area and at Terry's house, and returning to the party with injuries consistent with an attack and a person trying to defend themselves did not appear to be enough to pursue Dennis David. He was a suspect, but never arrested. Other potential suspects were brought in for tests as well, including Greg Morinville, Dennis Manning, Raymond, Sam Wilson, and Sam Manning. A third Raymond and two Sams. Lord, I hope I've made this clear enough that everyone can understand it. Greg Morinville is only mentioned in regard to the polygraph. It appeared he passed and was cleared as a suspect. I found an article mentioning his name, if it is the same person, saying that he was headed to training at Fort Lewis. So if that was the same guy, he was probably a soldier in the area who perhaps had interacted with Terry, but he was cleared. Dennis Manning and Sam Wilson were both exes of Terry's. Sam Manning was Dennis's cousin and was also the young man who gave a ride to Terry that final night. Next week, I'll be going more in depth with all of these ex-boyfriends. I'll be talking about Sam Manning, who was later convicted of rape, and Kenneth Haynes, the man who had Fawn Foster in his care, who was also charged with heinous sexual crimes. Could they be the ones to blame for Terry's murder?
We need like a some sort of
like a web.
Web of how people know each other, a tree with the photos.
It's bananas.
Red string connected to push pins.
I know. I feel like the picture with Charlie on the wall with the let me explain.
It reminds me of Game of Thrones, like the books all have, and you can look up the familial lines.
Listening to it, it's a lot more complicated. If you break it down, like I just wanted to go through all the people that were at the party. Basically, everyone that worked at Edelweiss had almost everyone had gone to the party.
Right.
And or had been at work. They saw that Terry was upset on the 23rd because of the holiday and her daughter being out of her care. And she's talking to Colleen. She doesn't go to the party. She goes out. Colleen and Dennis, her visiting brother, go to the party. Dennis leaves for a while, comes back beat up. They go home. Everyone talks to the cops. He's brought in after they find her body. And he's like, you know,
Might have done it.
I don't remember this moment, but it's a very possible.
What kind of drugs were they taking?
They never even imply that. There's never like, oh, he had issues with heroin. I think he tries to blame alcohol, but he's also just kind of like, oh, shit. Not like the other night I left some eggs out. Like, oh, shit, I shouldn't have been stoned and making dinner. I left the eggs out. Now they're garbage. Heck, that's basically what he what he's treating this with is like, oh, golly, did I do that? But his car matches. He was seen with marks on his face and neck. He's visiting from out of town. He admitted to going by her house to see if she wanted to go to the party, but she was still at the bar. There's so much against Dennis David. I don't know how he wasn't held.
Yeah, that's wild to me.
Just held, not arrested, not charged.
We've seen far worse with the results of a polygraph.
Yes.
You'd think they would have held him.
Yeah, so I don't know what it is. And it does get a little confusing because there are cousins and whatnot, but I hope I've kept it all separate enough that it does make sense. But yeah, so it's just crazy because her ex-boyfriend is a dentist and his cousin is who took her out that night. And it's like, it's very small
you
town.
You never hear names like Dennis anymore.
Well, you're going to hear him next week.
I look forward to it.
If you love the same three names, you're going to love this two-part series. Like I said, there have not been any arrests. People have died that were connected to it. And it's just a matter of like somebody knows something or someone knows that maybe one piece of evidence is missing that could at least say this is who this is or something. It's just wild to me that this is all laying out there. And again, this is all my opinion. This is from a police report. And I do want to give a big thank you and shout out to Gary Hughes Investigates. I stumbled upon this case, I believe, through newspapers.com. as we usually do and go, wait, what? This is unsolved? And Christmas Eve murder. And, you know, Christmas is coming up. When I was writing this, it was coming up. And I was like, oh, my gosh.
2025? Yeah.
Well, no, when I was still working on this, it was approaching Christmas. I'm like, oh, my gosh, it's the anniversary and there's nothing. The only thing I could find that had touched on this or mentioned this case was the YouTube page Gary Hughes Investigates. And he somehow has this extensive report, police report, all of these documents, and he was showing them. So I was literally taking screenshots of his YouTube page. And then I emailed him and I was like, hey, if it's possible. And, you know, you never know with people. Some people are very protective of their stuff. And I wasn't sure, you know, I just had stumbled upon him. I was like, is there any way I could find out about where you got these records or if I could look at them? And he sent me everything he had.
Oh, that's nice.
He was just like, oh, maybe a shout out. I'm like, absolutely. Anyone that's willing
we'll
to
put them in the blog too.
Share their info. It was just very helpful because instead of my 87 screenshots of half a page, I had full documents. I'm like, oh, this is much easier. So shout out.
You do what you got
to
do.
And a big thank you to Gary Hughes and for even touching on this case because it has no coverage. I feel like if there was even the slightest bit of heat, something could come from it.
Well, we'll find out a little more next week.
Hopefully this helps. And next week, oh boy. Yeah. Lots of criminal histories to go through.
Exciting.
Cool. Are you doing both parts today?
Oh, God, no. Okay. I'll be lucky if I can get through this first
Jesus
one.
Jesus Christ.
I don't know if we're ready for that.
Yeah. I can seriously feel my mouth already just from that ad. Oh, I'm like nervous. Oh, my God. How exciting.
I have to say the cutest thing this morning is like, are you excited to get the Scooby Gang back together?
I thought you were going to say Harry Hole's Junior Detectives.
That's right. Colored
Herbert's on a stripes.
Em, you ever pick up any street jeans?
I can't say that I have.
Considered part of these. I'm spermatozoa, an ass and.
Ass? Holy shit. Medical miracles.
What's this ash doing in this vagina? Apostrophe boy.
Pass on saying that.
Yeah.
Phosphatase.
This is actually a snippet I borrowed and tweaked from Emily's episode, which I didn't look up the name of, and I couldn't remember.
What an ass.
Well, because I didn't even know where to find it. It's the pain continued. That's all, folks. Millie supported Tim's concern, telling detectives that Tim Terry Millie. David remembered that about half an hour into, who was another new employee, who brought whore. Yeah, that was at you. Just, I wanted to sneak it in. I didn't want to tell it to your face.
Whore.
I just worked it into my script. Murder in the Rain is a Cascade Media production, written, hosted, and edited by Josh McCullough, Emily Rowney, and Alicia Holland. Feel free to email us at murderintherain@gmail.com or through our website, murderintherain.com. For as little as $1 a month, you can subscribe on Patreon to get exclusive access to ad-free and older episodes. For only $5, you can access Patreon-exclusive episodes and content. For more of us, be sure to follow on all the socials, listen to Josh and Alicia on their other show, Always Be My Sisters, and follow Emily on TikTok at @M_murderinTheRain. And suck my balls.